I would like to welcome each and every person here this evening. And the evening together falls into three primary areas. I also like to welcome Sahar, who was with us on the retreat in the kibbutz just recently, and like to express my deep appreciation to the rabbi of the synagogue and all the workers here at the synagogue for making the synagogue available. And I do think itself is a very important step, because there is so much religious misunderstanding that if we can meet and explore together various issues of life and what spiritual life is into religious issues of life, and meet together in each other's places of common exploration, that to me is a real important step forward in itself. And again, thank you, Sahar, and to everybody who is here. So with the evening time, I'd like to have with each and every one of us time for some meditation, 10-minute meditation together. Whenever I get the opportunity to speak in various places, I never let anybody get away without some meditation. And I don't intend to break this 25-year-old tradition that I'm trying to establish. So if we have just 10 minutes of sitting meditation, just two or three basic but helpful guidelines for this. One is that the 2 feet are firmly on the floor. Makes a little contribution towards being grounded in life. Secondly, that the back is reasonably straight and upright, and there is some expansion in the chest, diaphragm and stomach area. The spine therefore is reasonably straight. If you're feeling still some energy at the end of the day, the eyes can be closed. If you're feeling rather tired, then the eyes can be open. Key thing with meditation is being present to the presence of life, and therefore really establishing ourselves and having firm intention to be really right here, right now. Our existence is here, not in memories, it's not in future planning, certainly not in daydreams and fantasies, it's right here. And if we can really establish ourselves really right here, we can look at the past more calmly and clearly. We can look at future potentials and possibilities more calmly and clearly, because we're here and now, because we're well established. Help and a support for that is the mindfulness of breathing, and in giving care and attention to the breath, we're just aware of ourselves sitting on this earth, breathing in and breathing out, and just being aware of the breath as it comes, aware of the breath as it goes, and just being in touch with that. So if we have a 10-minute sitting meditation together, I'll give a reminder once or twice. If your mind wanders and drifts and runs around the planet like a wild monkey, please encourage it to come back to the here and now, to the present moment where we actually are. So we'll have a few minutes together, and I'll just give a reminder once or twice.
this is the book it was taken from.
So I'm going to read this story, and if I get lost in it, it's because, not because of the story, but because Christopher hasn't got his glasses with him. But I'll be all right. I'm too lazy to walk over there and get them. All right, so I'll begin. If you like. Yeah, thanks. So I'll start. The bride and the groom were also very happy, and they started to remember all the good that the dear Lord had given them while they were in the forest. And they wept and felt longing. So they thought, how do we bring here the first beggar, the blind? I've got the glasses, it is. Then take a little digging here. Would you like to read? Well, I'll.
We should wait for you.
Eh? You should wait for me.
Yes.
Okay. Somewhere in the mountain of things in here, there's a pair of glasses.
Observe the watching.
Yeah, surely. Glasses we have. All right, here we go.
It's even better than mine.
Eh? Yeah. Well, worn out things. All right. Okay, so I'll start again if I may. I think you can. Can you hear me? Yes. And the bride and the groom were also very happy, and they started to remember all the good that the dear Lord had given them while they were in the forest, and they wept and felt longings. So they thought, how do we bring here the first beggar, the blind one, that gave us bread in the forest? As soon as they thought of that beggar, he stood and said, here I am. I came to your wedding, and my present to you is that you will be as old as I, and that you shall live as long as me. And think you that I am blind? Not at all, I am not blind. It is just that the whole time of the world does not count to me more than the blink of the eye. Therefore he seems to the others as blind, since he does not see what is in this world. And I am very old, and yet a total infant, and I still haven't started living, and I am still ancient. And it is not only I who say it, but I also have consent about from the great eagle, and I will tell you a story. These were the words of the blind beggar. Once upon a time, some people went to sea in a lot of ships, and there came a great wind that broke the ships, and the people were saved and came to a great tower. They climbed to the tower and found there all they need, food, drinks and clothing, all the goods and the pleasures in this world. They decided that each would tell an old story, the first thing he can remember, meaning his first memory. And since they were old and young, and they gave the oldest one the honor of telling the first story, he opened and said, what shall I tell you? I remember when they took the apple from the tree. And nobody knew what he was telling, but some figured this was a very old story. Then they asked the next one to talk, and he said, that was younger, said, is that an old story?
It is very rich. Is that an old story?
Oh, all right. Okay. Thank you. Please come in any time with those. I wouldn't dare. I can remember that story as well, but I also remember when the candle was lit and all around said, this is truly an old story. And they wondered, how is it that the second one, which was younger, remembered a story that was older? They then called a third one, which was younger yet, and he said, I can remember when the fruit began being, when it started to build. And they said, indeed, this is a most ancient story. The fourth one, which was younger, said, I remember when they took the seed to the plant the fruit. The fifth, even younger, said, I can remember the wise ones while they planted the seed. And the sixth said, I remember the taste of the fruit even before it was in the fruit. And the seventh said that he remembers the smell of the fruit before it became the fruits. Then the eighth said that he remembers the shape of the fruit before it formed the fruit itself. And I, meaning the blind beggar which told the whole story, was there, being only a baby. And I said, I remember all those tales, and I remember nothing.
Und ich gedank gar nicht.
And they all said, this is really the oldest of them all. And they saw it as a new thing that the baby remembers more than the elders. While they were telling those tales, came a great eagle, knocked on the tower, and said, you shall be poor no more. Go back to your treasures and use them. And he told them to leave the tower by the order of their years, so that the elders should go first. Then he took the baby first, since he was indeed the oldest. And the great eagle said, I shall explain the tales that each told. The one that said he remembers when they cut the apple from the tree means he recalls when they cut his navel, the moment he was born. Second remembered the burning candle means he remembers when he was conceived, and he recalls the candle in the room. The third, which remembered the forming of the fruit, means he remembers the forming of the embryo. And the one who remembers when they took the seed to plant the fruit actually recalls the drop that made the mating. And the one that remembered the wise man thinking of the seed recalls the drop being in the brain, since it is the brain where the drop is made. The one who remembers the taste means the soul, and scent is the spirit, and the shape is the mind. And the infant said, he remembers nothing because he is above it all, and he remembers what was before, the nothing. And then the eagle said, go back to your ships that are your broken bodies, and build them anew. And he blessed them. And to me, the blind beggar, that was the baby that is telling the story, the great eagle said, you come with me because you are like me. You are very old and yet very young. You have yet to start living while being very ancient, and so am I. So that you see, I have consent from the great eagle, and now I give you my long life as present. And there was immense joy and great happiness all around. Nice. Who's going to give a little comment on the story here? Would you like to give a little comment?
I thought, once again, what I really like about this story, like, rings an inner bell of wonderful Zen qualities, the baby that remembers more, and
yes.
Sort of, I thought, asking you, since, I mean...
All right. Well, I haven't got such a good memory, I have to say. yeah. But if I give a little commentary for 5 minutes, and if during the 5 minutes time you find a suitable question that you'd like to follow on from, and then I'll give a little more commentary, and then we'll flow back and forth. Does that seem... Would that be right with people for a little while? Okay. While reading the story, memory, even when, as we know, when we're speaking, can enter in, and what we see with our inner life, its capacity to, in this case, language to come out, to verbalize and express things. And while that is actually taking place, thoughts can arise in our mind, and there can be a certain kind of association. So as I spoke, my mind went back just for a moment or two to 31 years ago. And I think it has a certain kind of relationship to this story. I had been on the road, if I may say, for about 3 years, hitchhiking mostly, 30 countries by that time, and I was in Thailand, and I went to see a teacher named Ajahn Buddhadasa. Ajahn means teacher, Buddha, and Dasa means servant of the Buddha. And he lived in the forest for more than 60 years, and I put a question to him, just about life. And his immediate response was, if one really wants to go deeply into the experience of living, one must free oneself from all forms of clinging and holding and attachment in order to free the mind up to see well and clearly. And then he took hold of his robe, which was draped across his shoulder, and just kind of pulled it off, and he said, including this robe, this piece of cloth. After about 17 days in the forest, in a hut, I went down to him, and I was quite determined to take the steps to take ordination as a Buddhist monk. And then he said to me, what seemed to me a rather surprising statement when I spoke to him, he said to me, anybody who changes their religion, this will please you, anybody who changes their religion does so because they haven't understood their own. And so then he took absolutely no notice of my interest for ordination and all that went with it. So then I went away. Then I asked him a little bit more what he meant by this, and then he said, do you really want to understand the essence of all religious teachings? And I said, that's exactly why I want to ordain. I have no other reason to want to do that. Then he said, if you really want to understand the essence of your religion, and of course Christian background, Roman Catholic upbringing, and I said once or twice to my mother that she's more a Roman Catholic than the Pope, and he said, what all you have to do, go to the Bible, turn to Genesis, and you will see in the very first page of the Bible that the first essential teaching in the Bible is that Adam and Eve were told not to bite on the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. Not to bite on the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. If you look, he said, at that, if you go into that, that's all you need to understand about what the essence of religion is all about. I went, whoa. So then he sent me away. Sent me out of the monastery. That's it, you know, chalo. Those of you been to India can translate. And and so I went actually hitchhiked back up through, this is in southern Thailand, 12 hours from Bangkok, hitchhiked right back up through Thailand, through the north, through Udon, crossed the Mekong River, went up through up into Laos and the villages up in Laos where the Americans were waging at that time a secret war on the people of Laotia, of Laos. There, stayed in the monasteries up in the hills and the villages, and then I thought, I'm not taking no for an answer. So I went back across the Mekong, back down to Bangkok, back down, and I said, I'm back for ordination. So he said, okay, you're serious. And then I took ordination. So sometimes, as another example of what I mean, if I recall correctly in the Psalms of David in the Torah, there is a line or a sentence, be still and know that I am God. And to me, that again, for those of religious leanings and I have a comfort with religious language, sometimes in the busyness of our mind, of any religion, of the preoccupation with doing, 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 getting, 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 some of the deep and mysterious and mystical things of life we actually overlook. And though religion, in its best, does endeavor to give us a real reminder of profound things of life, we often overlook it, we often get caught up in all the ritual and the ceremony, and we forget the great significance of stillness in life. To be still. To be utterly still. Where to be so utterly still, as some of us know in the way of meditation, that if we just move our hand to scratch our shoulder, move our foot or whatever, sometimes it genuinely feels through our experience that we've actually done too much, just to move. And sometimes in stillness there is a kind of receptivity which is available to you and I, which we will never know through doing, doing, doing. And of course our culture and our society gives no encouragement to stillness. It gives encouragement and is very persuasive upon us about doing, doing, doing. So our ways of being in this world, could they possibly come from stillness rather than compulsive doing? And I think this is a very important question for us, and one which needs exploration. Anything we'd like to say, comment, ask here? Shall I carry on? No, just interrupt any time, you know, etc. So again, as I mentioned a moment or two ago, sometimes in our way of with this world that we live in, there is much externalized activity which is taking place. And if you and I look and give attention to our life, we see that in our life, our roles and our identities which build up in our life. And so you and I sit here, we take a little reflection, we say, well, who am I? Who am I? And if somebody comes up to us in the street and says, well, who are you? Our normal response is to give our, if we're feeling sociable that day, is to give our name, is to give possibly one, two, or three roles that we have. I'm a worker, I'm a student, I am a mother, I am a son, or whatever. And our sense of who we are gets formed and established through our roles. And much of our pleasures in life and our pains in life are in our roles.
Like our memories, sir.
Right. No, never mind that Sir Christopher's the name. All right. Yeah, okay. So, as you say, so here is, in our life, our movement of our life going on, and as you point out, here are our memories, and our memories and our impressions of who we are come and they keep arising naturally in our mind, and we say, this is who I am. And we have a certain kind of identity which states who we are. And that identity often matters to us, and it also matters to other people. They approve of it or disapprove of it. There. And if you think of the difficulties that we have, the ups and downs that we have, the problems that we have, how much of it is in and through the roles which we have? And therefore our sense of who I am, by memory, by image, by picture, is confirmed through the role. So this role, I don't care what the role is, whether it's called Dalai Lama, whether it's called rabbi, whether it's called Dharma teacher or whatever, this role is by a social agreement. What does that mean? This role is by an agreement. This role is by other people saying you are this and oneself saying I am this. So right now, as a very small example of what I mean, we might say, Saha has come as a student in the Reformed Rabbi tradition, and he is a student, and we are having some meeting together. Christopher has come as a Dharma teacher. Dharma means teachings and practices concerned with liberation and an enlightened life, and that's the role. But the role requires your affirmation. And in a very simple way for your affirmation, if you don't like it, you can change it. You could get up and start singing. You could just start making a noise or chatting to your neighbor or making a few calls on the mobile while you are sitting here. What would happen to my little role up here? it would get, there would be an impact on it. And if I'm strongly identified, hey, wait a minute, I'm the teacher here, and I'm strongly identified with my role, then clearly somebody else saying, I couldn't care less, mate, about your role, you know, I want to ring up my lover tonight in here instead, or, you know, start work on my new book or something. And immediately the role feels pressure, it feels threatened, it feels ignored, it feels under attack. And if I've got a strong identity with Dharma teacher is who I am, the probability I'm not going to be very happy with the person who's singing the Alleluia chorus at the same time as I'm talking. So this role is by agreement. To be absolutely honest, the agreement at the moment is you keep silent and I keep talking. That's the agreement. So we put so much into things, into who I am, and because we feel at the time this is who I am. And Dharma teachings, whether it's Zen, whether it's Advaita, whether it's deep spirituality, says, who am I before my role arises? Who am I with no role? Who am I with no identity?
I believe this is exactly the idea of the remembering. People are saying, well, what is the first memory? Before I became myself, before I had a name,
yes.
Before my parents gave me a name. Mm. So what is the first thing that the mind, mm. the soul remembers, and they're trying to go back and back and back and back, and then the oldest of them, which is actually the youngest of them, there was a baby coming here before.
So
I'm sure he remembers more than we do.
Yes.
He's connected in a way that we do not connect anymore.
Mm-hmm. But, we can't go backwards. We're on the birth movement through the aging process towards the other end of the situation.
Yes,
more closer to it than what we like to admit.
I can try not to have masks.
No.
Between me, mask is like saying I am a rabbi, I am Jewish,
right.
I am a pianist, I am so and so.
Yes.
There is the role that saying I'm Jewish is a role, but
of course it is.
It's a role I choose to myself.
Yes. So in that, here's our life manifesting, as I said, through the roles, which are very, very, you know, important, except in all the ways that it shows itself. And in the story there was, and various ways, interesting and subtle ways, that sometimes consciousness, as it were, can turn to the past, and there is subtle recollections. And this sometimes happens with some people quite spontaneously, sometimes it happens in meditation, sometimes it happens through the therapies, other consciousness movement activities, and then we turn to the past and the memory comes and we say, I can recall and remember this. But that recollection, that memory in these kind of teachings is important, it's subtle, but it doesn't tell us who we are, because it's as though we're going in a direction called to the past. Finding out who we are is who am I before the movement and the activities actually get underway. That means in life, it's not easy, are we willing to explore the changes in roles that go on? One, to really see that one role arises and then it appears for a time, it drops. Then another role arises, and then it drops, and that we're moving in and out of a world of roles which men and women agree or disagree over. And it's become so important to us, so vital, so much energy is going into all of this, we actually think the role is the reality, is the real truth of life. It's not. And the consequences of not understanding this for us is all the conflict. One could not have conflict without our being in some way identified with the situation And as someone said to me a day or two ago, when we just think about ourselves, which means think about our role and identity, and only do that, we can't see the other, because we're trapped in this. Yes.
Taking off the roles.
Yes.
And trying to see what is the behind.
Hmm.
What is the behind?
All right. In the story, there's rather a key word here called beggar. And in the tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, the word beggar has a spiritual meaning. When, if we just jump back 2,500 years for a moment or two ago with you, when men and women went into themselves and into deep spiritual explorations, and all that's implied with that, one was described as a beggar. A beggar is one who has nothing and holds to nothing, and therefore is nobody. Our general world that you and I live in doesn't like this idea one bit. Not one bit. And sometimes, as we know, they're always around. So can listen. We'll meditate while you talk. Anyway, we won't listen. So sometimes, as I say, there's a stepping back from things. And there are moments in our day, every day, when we're not doing anything special, we're not in any particular role, we're not having anything going on in our mind, we're not doing anything for ourselves, nor anything for anybody. Could it be that these moments are really precious? Could it be? And perhaps the only way you and I are going to find out is by the experience in the day, in certain moments, of not being engaged in doing, to be silent, to be still, as we were at the beginning, and to rather be patient, and to rather see what happens when I don't have a role in the moment. What happens when I've got nothing to do? What happens when I don't have a particular position? It may feel initially rather insecure. One may feel rather worried, rather anxious. My God, what am I going to do? I've been doing my whole life, and now I'm just allowing myself to stop. But there is a possibility in that for some finding out a deeper truth of who we are. Please.
If
go on.
There is a very nice story about Rabbi Zushia,
mm-hmm,
telling that when he will die and stand in heaven, nobody will ask him, why haven't you been Moses?
Mm-hmm.
They will ask him, why haven't you been Zushia? So I ask you, if you think that we having these roles, these masks that we put on ourselves, but if you take all these masks away, there is the true, what is yourself?
Yes. Yep.
Is it a destiny?
Destiny. Hard question. Dear, oh dear.
Is Christopher, pure Christopher?
No.
Your role in life, your job in life is to find out what is this real Christopher.
No, thank God. Sometimes my life is going by and I think I share some my roles, whoever I am, I have in common with other people. I say, oh, there are other people who are doing what I do and other people are doing different things and all of that. And then I think, is there something which makes me unique? Something that's really different from other people? All that I can say in spending most of my adult life in spiritual, my whole life in spiritual life because of my Catholic upbringing and my involvement in that, that I have not yet, and in more than 30 years of meditation in all sorts of environments and situations, hand on heart, I have not found one single thing inside of me which I consider unique. That includes 3.5 years in a monastery where I couldn't speak Thai language, the best part of a year in a cave, in solitude, 3 years wandering up and down the ashrams of India, done every practice imaginable. I have not found one thing inside which is unique. And if I do, I'll send you an email. Something happens as we look deeper into our life, which rather than say, there's something about me called Christopher, or you called Saha, which is unique, something happens in going deeper, which actually dissolves this idea, I am special and I am unique. You're breathing deeply here, it's telling me something, but hang in, let me just finish these three sentences. And what actually happens is, that what I do experience as a man or a human being on this earth, not unique, something profoundly in common, something which is shared and is of the same nature with all men and women and all children and all beings. And the sooner this uniqueness and specialness dissolves out of this idea of I, me and my is unique, the quicker and the sooner I'll see that others share the same nature. Therefore, doing for others in a genuine way is actually doing for oneself. And it's that much in common that we have. Okay, over to you.
I deeply agree with everything you said. It's just now I understand that we don't call it in the same name. Right. The lion has a destiny to eat the antelope. It is not bad, it is his destiny.
All right.
Now Christopher has a...
Well, I'm a vegetarian for a start.
No, but
anyway, I know what you mean. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, I could check you with it. All right.
So you have a special DNA, you have special... I mean, of course you are unique. Everyone is unique, every creature is unique.
Maybe a little bit with the language here. To put it in another way. I would have to focus as a human being on something and take it away from everything else to say I'm unique. But if I look even at my common level of experience, I say DNA. At my common level of experience, I say feelings and emotions. At a common level, perceptions. And a common level, thoughts. At a common level, consciousness. At a common level, I'm passing through this life. At a common level, I enjoy to be happy, and I'm not too enthused about getting unhappy. So I have an enormous amount in common, and I think what I have in common and what we have in common with each other matters far more than differences.
Of course.
Every time. So as you can tell, to put it in a very polite English way, I'm extremely reluctant to use anything unique.
I respect this.
All right. Just because then I might make a difference, and I can't see it.
That is just that you have the right to choose your way in life. If you wish, you can be a good person. If you wish, you can be evil person. The lion that I have mentioned has no choice. His destiny, as I said, is to eat the antelope, and you choose to go in a good way, and teaching which is leads people to the good way. Once again, you have, you mm-hmm. could do other things, but you choose to do.
All
you
right.
choose to live your life.
Thank you for the kind word, but I'll have to change and have a look another way. We in our culture are mad about the word choice, madly in love with it. Makes me feel a little uneasy, even though it's a nice idea. And it got a strong movement, the word choice, sorry, it got a strong movement, the word choice. Actually, in the last couple of decades, this word has got used a great deal about personal choices. And that a person can choose to be good, or choose to be not good, or choose to be evil, as though each man and woman can just make that kind of decision. This viewpoint, I have to say, originated in the United States, in certain circles, And like a virus, it got exported along with Burger King, McDonald's, Coca-Cola and everything else. And now it's landed in the synagogue. It's a funny world. So let's just look at a little bit at choice. How many of us chose to look the way we do? Going back to the story for a moment, we weren't hanging out in outer space and said, well, I think I'll be born in Israel, and I think I'll be male this time, and I think I'll be on the short side, I was longer the last time. No! Where was the choice? One, when we're feeling worried, anxious, fearful, angry, stressed out, when we go to bed at night, and the mind is like the old car engine in a hot summer's day, put the head down on the pillow and turn the car engine off, pull the key out, the car is still ticking over. You know, I had a 1983 Toyota, I know this from experience. I haven't got it anymore. And put the head on the pillow and the mind is still going on. It wants to see the end of the world for the night. It doesn't want any more memories. It doesn't want to hear anything, see anything, smell anything, taste anything, touch anything. It doesn't want a single thought, a single emotion. It just wants to see the end of this world for at least 6 or 7 hours unbroken. Unhappy, confused, depressed, angry, upset, stressed out. Do we say, do we say, I think I'll be a really miserable sod today. I think tonight I'm going to have a really sleepless night. Can't get off to sleep. I think I'm going to get really angry with my neighbours today. Yeah? I think I'm really going to be... I think worry is my big thing. I'll choose worry. I'll choose worry. And in this country, there's nobody on earth who knows about worry like you lot, I have to say. Don't mind me saying. You've made a speciality. It's almost unique. worry about yourselves, worry about the family, worry about your friends, you worry about your country. You are the kings and queens of worry. There. But nobody says, I think I'll choose it. So choice makes me feel, because things that matter to us don't seem to come out of choice. The things that matter don't seem to come from choice. Who would choose those states of mind? We might say, well, I choose to have go and buy a red t-shirt today instead of a black t-shirt. Wow! That's real choice. So I think we have to look in life inwardly and to look in fresh ways, to bring more awarenesses, challenges the idea of choice that we have, and to see, well, what do I need to look at? What way can I explore these areas? And perhaps challenge this notion around everybody has a choice. It makes me feel uncomfortable.
Suppose you meet a situation in your life.
Yeah.
And in this situation, there are several ways you can react to. And let's take the most simple. There is a banana on the floor.
Yes.
You can pick it up or not picking up.
Yeah.
Both ways, you have affected reality.
Yes. That's true.
So, I must say you have chosen.
I see. All right. Yeah.
And once again, I'm thinking, I have life... said so, Rabbi Nachman of Basra, that life is a very narrow bridge and the most important thing is not to be afraid at all. Very famous also, very famous song. And one bank of this very narrow bridge is thing that we do not control, to be male, to be born in Israel, to have a car accident and etc. But from the other side of the other bank, there is a thing that you do take choice in your life. How do you react?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that destiny is calling you, but you have to call. I mean, you can choose to go to the army or not to go to the army. You can choose to pick the banana or not to pick the banana. I mean, and so on.
Right. So I agree. I don't want to be totally against the idea of choice. Just 90% jury. And in that, if we're going to make choices in that way that you said, let's make choices which do express some kind of genuine awareness, real concern, and a real determination to look at life and face it. If we're going to make choice, let's make a choice which is really worthwhile. I do believe a lot of choices that we make are shallow, superficial. And I remember going with a friend of mine, and she, a few years ago, she wanted to buy a pair of shoes. Now, it's not the biggest adventure in existence. So I said I'd accompany her to buy a pair of shoes. Some of you have had the misfortune to go to London in your life, and you know the street called Oxford Street. It's one hell of a long street, full of people shopping, many tourists. We started at one end, which was at the Tottenham Court Road end, and she wanted a special pair of shoes in a special way. And I, honestly, we walked down one side, right to the very far end, which is called Marble Arch. We went in more shoe shops than I've ever seen in my life. She still couldn't find exactly what she wanted. Crossed over. We walked all the way back, which took the afternoon, to Tottenham Court Road. She still didn't find. And my comment was, I've worn out my shoes walking around shoe shops. One could say she had a choice and dragged poor Christopher with her choice. You know, I could have chosen not to go and hang out and had a cafe latte. So sometimes in that, the idea image is so fixed that we can't see beyond it. We call it a choice, but actually we're fixed. We're using the language of choice, but we're trapped in the idea. And we want to see, can I look at the way I get trapped? It's called a pair of shoes. It's called a career. It's called making money. It's called being a Buddhist. It's called having a partner. It's called not having a partner, or whatever. We might just realize and look, if we really attend to, perhaps we're really restricting ourselves. We're calling it choice, but sometimes we may have the choice and it doesn't happen. One really wants to be in a relationship. I hear this on every retreat I give. And beautiful women and beautiful men come on relationships, and sometimes I wonder whether I'm running a retreat or a partner forming agency, all in the silence, I might add. And even with beautiful men and women, that sometimes a relationship doesn't happen. It would be hard to say, well, that's your choice. So sometimes we may make the choice and the wish, but it doesn't actualize. Can we be clear about that? Can our heart be steady with that? So that in fact wisdom and clarity and the depth of that matters more than often than what we choose. And all of that is a challenge to us, how we use our life, how we manifest our life, and the kind of choices that we make. And sometimes our choices work out beautifully well, and I think when choices and events work out beautifully well, regard it as an extraordinary coincidence. And sometimes things don't work out so well in all the ways. Can we be steady and say, life is not meant for the self? Life is not meant just to fulfill everything I choose. Life is not meant to fit in with all of my wishes. It is not made this way. And if we can understand that really deeply, we will live clear with life. Because it's not made to fit in with what every individual wants and chooses. And somehow we've got to understand this in our bones. Then life can be fun and joyful, and we're very clear life is not made just for myself. At any level. Any response? I'm getting off easy here. Thank you. So, I would like, we'll have more than a half hour, 40 minutes together. Now, just one little thing I'd like to mention because of the situation. Here, and you and I have spoken a little bit, if we talk about the language of choices here. I gave a talk yesterday evening at the Mind Body Center, and during the talk yesterday evening, I expressed my concerns, and I'm so sure all of us here share them as well, about this current situation of conflict that is taking place in this country, and particularly, of course, with the Palestinian community. I've been coming here since 1992, and for 3 to 4 years, we had a dialogue program, and one of our teachers, Stephen Fulda, very much an instrumental force in establishing this program. And in this program that we had, and the connections that we had, I had the chance and the opportunity this week to spend 24 hours in Srem, in Nablus, and to give a one-day workshop which took place there. And in that, I had meetings with, of course, with the Palestinians. And there are just two or three things that I'd like to mention about many things. I was talking and listening for over 18 hours with them. And one which really stood out to me, and the numbers of people that I talked with, and these are people who are frontline people insofar they're in the small towns and villages working with people who have been very much affected very, very directly by this military occupation and all the consequences. And one thing which was noticeably lacking in this was that there was a real absence of blame towards the people of Israel. And I've heard blame from Palestinians before, and I really noticed this time that did not take place, yet I was hearing